Okay, welcome back. Apologize, I have a pretty bad head cold, so bear with me. Before we get started today, Rodney Avila's brought to my attention, and I agree that I'd like to ask the council to take a moment of silence to recognize stalwart in the industry, and Rodney wanted to say a couple of words.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. With sad news, we lost one of our great icons in New Bedford, Howard Nickerson, at the age of 97 years old. Howard, ever since I can remember, I met Howard when I was 19 years old. Actually, he threw me out of the first union meeting I ever attended. His problem was he let me back in. But I drove to a lot of council meetings with Howard, learned a lot from him. He was very knowledgeable in the industry. He was always there for the industry, promoted the industry any way he could. And I'd just like to have a moment of silence in his recognition, his passing. Thank you.
Thank you, Rodney. I have nothing urgent to report or announce, so before I move on to the next agenda item, are there any questions or concerns about the agenda as we've laid out? Okay, just to remind everyone to put their phones on silence. Try to take a break about every hour and a half. Moving right into reports on recent activities, Executive Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 2 weeks ago, Rip, John, and I went to Washington for a annual Chairman's Coordinating Committee meeting with NIMS leadership. We discussed budget, and our budget for 2010 is very good. The councils collectively... their budgets were raised by $5 million. Our share of that is 700 and something thousand, so we've got a very good budget for 2010. Also at the meeting, we discussed Ocean Policy Act. If you recall old H.R. 21, which didn't go very far, the Oceans Policy Act is gaining a lot of momentum. There is the interim report is out, which establishes a governance structure. At the top, there's a National Oceans Council. There's a National Governance Advisory Committee. And there's local, regional prioritization and coordination that's done through state organizations like NROC and Gulf of Mexico Alliance and California Channel, et cetera. So it's a very unique organization. It's in draft form as an interim policy statement. There is some concern that it may be established by executive order as opposed to going through and becoming a bill. The councils have commented on this Oceans Policy Act, and it's going through the different chairmen for signatures now. As soon as that's complete, I'll send you off a copy of what the council chairman commented on that act. Needless to say, we're going to get very busy on becoming members of the NROC if we can. That's the Northeast Regional Ocean Council that's been established in the New England states by the five governors. Just in general, the councils were very concerned that there's no fisheries at the table anywhere within that organization. So we're very concerned about that. There was also discussion about marine spatial planning, which comes under this new Oceans Policy Act. Again, with all our fishery closures and rotational area managements and habitat protection, if there's any talk about marine spatial planning, the councils need to be at the table. MPAs is also coming into its final implementation, and there's a lot of concern about what's called a gap analysis. The MPA group will be looking at what's called a gap analysis, what is needed and what is in place, and trying to identify the gap. So we're very concerned about that, as we are concerned about once an MPA is established, you can't do any harm to it. So we're concerned about a number of things with MPAs and have been. So I will be getting, there's a lot of presentations about the Ocean Policy Act, presentations about marine spatial planning and MPAs that I'll be giving you all copies of once I have them made from that meeting. Skates, the proposed rule for skates came out after we published our agenda for this meeting. Andy is reviewing the skate proposed rule, and if there's any comments that we need to make, I suggest we work through the executive committee and the chair, because the deadline is before the next council meeting. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions for Paul? Dave?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say, as far as the comments that the CCC made on the interim report and the marine spatial planning, I think that your comments were extremely well done. The CCC devoted serious thought to it, and we also took that up with the Habitat Committee and identified many of the same concerns that you people had. But I thought that you did an excellent job of articulating them, and I think that, well, we're going to be talking about that tomorrow anyway. But I just want to commend the CCC on their work on it. Thank you.
Dave Pierce.
Yeah, Paul, you mentioned MPAs and some concern regarding MPAs, but specifically you said that once MPAs are established, no harm can be done. Would you elaborate a little bit? What's the context for that particular statement?
Part of the executive order says that you can't have make harm to existing MPAs. It said
avoid harm.
You must avoid harm to existing MPAs. So the councils are very concerned that if we have a closed area like closed area 1 or closed area 2, and we're protecting habitat or we're rebuilding stocks, and it's designated as an MPA, then if we want to allow access to those areas on a full-time or temporary basis or change the boundaries in any way, if that's looked at as, what's the word again? Inflicting harm. It's not avoiding harm. So we're very concerned about that. And there's been no resolution to that I'm aware of.
So you're referencing the executive order of quite a few years ago.
Right.
Okay.
Dave? Oh, Pat.
Just to expand on that a little bit, but, of course, the executive order has no regulatory there's no regulatory authority within the executive order, so the regulatory authority still would be entirely within the council's purview. And the flip side of the coin is, in some ways, it's like our EFH designation, where now we can, for example, if there is a proposal for a dredging project, we can provide comments consistent with avoiding harm to EFH. And so there's some potential benefit there for fishery resources. So I think it is a bit unclear what how it's going to play out, the avoid harm provision, but it does not provide any regulatory authority. So that's all still within the individual regulatory entity's authority.
The order is 13-158, if anybody wants to look it up, the executive order. My wife's on the MPA advisory committee. If you want, I can call her up, and she's not working today. I can have her come up and answer questions for people. But it's also my understanding that there's a nomination process for this, that the MPAs have to be nominated by somebody. And as an example, we could choose not to nominate our closed areas because of concern for this. However, something like Stellwagen Bank, the Marine Sanctuary, they can nominate Stellwagen, and we have no say in that because it's a separate entity. I mean, any number of entities can nominate MPA areas to be considered as MPA areas. And how that's all going to play out, I don't think has been clearly delineated yet.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. To that point, the process of listing right now, what should be listed in each region is going on. So the process is that the regional administrator will consult with the council and get input on what should be designated within our region as an MPA. So the other councils are going through that now with their RA. I've spoken with Pat, and when a number of things are off our plate, then she's going to come to us, and we're going to have that discussion about what do we want to list as an MPA. But I don't know if Pat has any time frame on that.
Yeah. we've actually already been through the process with the Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council, and they are nominating their tilefish EFH areas for the MPA designation. And just to take a step back a minute, so the council makes the recommendation, make the recommendation to the MPA process, and then it goes through a proposed and final rulemaking type of thing before the designation happens, and then it's up to, and if you want to take it off the designated list, that's again would be the council's decision. So Mid-Atlantic is nominating some of their areas for MPA designation under the executive order. And I sent a letter to the Mid-Atlantic asking them to make recommendations for MPA designations. Every council but New England at this point has gotten that letter. And so I'm going to have to send it to New England soon, just workload issues. We've been waiting to do New England last. But I expect within a couple of months anyway, I'll need to send the letter here. And so what we'd do is send the letter to you, and when it's convenient for the council, set up some time on the council agenda to have folks from the MPA program here and folks from my staff here to answer everyone's questions.
Any other questions for Paul? Pat Kirkle.
Thanks, John. Well, as, I'm sure you've heard by now the Amendment 16 to the multi-species FMP was approved by the Secretary of Commerce last week, with the exception of the one provision, the pilot program for sink gillnet vessels. All the other measures in Amendment 16 were approved. Three other pieces to this puzzle, this multi-species puzzle. The amendment itself has been approved. We've also got the proposed rule going through the process. The comment period on the proposed rule closed last week on the 20th, on January 20th. And so these are the regulations that would implement Amendment 16, and those will be published, we hope anyway, sometime in April. The third piece of the puzzle are the sector operations plans. Those have also been going through the public review process, and the 17 of them have been out for public comment. The comment period on those closed on January 21st. And the same thing that we're hoping that the final rule for the sector operations plans will be published somewhere by the end of April. And then the final piece in the puzzle is Framework Adjustment 44. Well, I don't imagine there's ever any final piece to this puzzle. Sorry. One other piece of the puzzle is Framework Adjustment 44, and we're hoping that the proposed rule for that publishes very soon. That'll have a short comment period, and the goal is to also have that in place, of course, by May 1st, and so hopefully to have a final rule for Framework 44 sometime in April. The U.S., the TMGC, the Transboundary Management Guidance Committee, U.S. and Canadian representatives met on January 14th in Portland, Maine to discuss issues related to the concerns that we've had with finding a mutually agreeable approach to yellowtail flounder in particular. And concerns about the flexibility in the U.S. process that may have contributed to the difficulties that we're having in that process. There was considerable discussion at the meeting about the bills that have been proposed in Congress and the feeling that those could help certainly alleviate much of the concern and introduce additional flexibility in the process. But also discussion about alternatives should those bills not be successful, and having to do, and I think it centers around timing issues basically, and how the TMGC recommendation and the SSC recommendation fit together and when they occur in the process. And I'm hoping that at some point later in this meeting, we'll have some opportunity to talk about that a little bit more, maybe under the SSC scheduling discussion. Days at sea leasing, total leases process 711. This is from May 1 through January 21st. Total leases process 711. Total leases approved 670. That's 682 distinct fishing permits. The total number of days at sea leased was just over 14,000. On herring, the Office of Management and Budget has approved the Paperwork Reduction Act request for the new collection of information associated with the closed Area 1 midwater trawl release caught end affidavit form. And a final rule is under development to implement the new reporting requirements. Details of the affidavit were published on November 2nd in the final rule that implemented the new requirements. The affidavit will provide NIMS with additional details of any closed Area 1 tow where circumstances necessitate releasing catch unobserved. For Atlantic Sea Scallops, we have finally completed all the IFQ appeals, and the IFQ program will go into effect on March 1, 2010. There are 328 IFQ vessels, 40 vessels that have both an IFQ and a limited access days at sea permit. In addition, there are 107 Northern Gulf of Maine and 288 incidental catch permits. Effective March 1st, the total allowable catch for IFQ vessels, that's the 328 vessels, will be 2.3 million pounds. The TAC for vessels with both the IFQ and scallop days at sea, the 40 vessels, will be 225,753 pounds. The IFQs for vessels, of course, will be calculated using these TACs. We expect to send a letter very soon that includes the individual IFQ percent share and IFQs. Keep in mind that the TAC effective March 1st are carried over from 2009 and will change under Framework 21. This will also change every individual IFQ under the current Framework 21 proposed action. IFQs would be reduced. And the tax would be lower than they are in 2009. I wanted to make people aware that several vessels have qualified for limited access general category permits but have not renewed into the 2009 fishing year. If the vessels don't renew their permits by February 28th, they'll no longer be eligible for their limited access general category permits. We've sent reminders to all of these vessels. We're going to be sending another reminder. This is a bit of a mystery to us why people would go through the process of qualifying for the permit and then fail to renew and effectively lose that permit. So I want to do what we can to keep putting the word out on that. For skates, as Paul mentioned, we published a proposed rule on January 21st to implement Amendment 3 to the skate FMP, and the comment period on that closes February 22nd. This is the action that would implement a rebuilding plan for smooth skate and new biomass reference points for the other skate species based on the recommendations of the Northeast Data Poor Stocks Working Group. Let's see. We have closed the period 2 quota for spiny dogfish effective January 26th. The fishery for spiny dogfish is closed, and new quota will not become available until May 1st, 2010. Let's see. We published final 2010 summer flounder scup and black sea bass specifications on December 22nd. However, we received and are reviewing a request from the Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council to increase by emergency action the 2010 black sea bass total allowable landing limit as a result of a revised increased ABC acceptable biological catch recommendation from their SSC. Almost there. One more. We published a final rule in the Federal Register on January 8th that authorizes us to increase to issue a temporary possession LOA letter of authorization to eligible vessels that would be temporarily in possession of restricted species for the purpose of collecting catch data. The rule becomes effective February 8th. This temporary possession LOA will allow eligible vessels to forego the full EFP exempted fishery permit process, which includes the solicitation of public comments and consultation, to obtain the permit without going through that entire process. So this should facilitate the issuance of these LOAs for some research vessels. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Rodney?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pat, you'd mentioned that some of these new general category permits hadn't been renewed. Just my thinking. A lot of these have been transferred since they had their allocation. They've been sold to another entity, another business. And maybe your mailing address went to the old person who had previously owned a permit, and it didn't go to the new person that had the permit. So that might be an answer to that question.
Well, that's possible, but for the transfer to be effective, they would have had to come to us to get the new permit. So that's why I said it's a bit of a mystery.
Well, my question, was it sent to the old one or was it sent to the new one after it got transferred? That's basic.
Mary Beth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a call from a general category scallop person, and there were some concerns about the development of the cost recovery program for the IFQ. And I wonder if Pat could just tell us, you know, how the agency is approaching that, how you would be evaluating the need for a cost recovery for the general category.
Yeah, neither George or I are up on the specifics of it. There is a cost recovery program; it's required under this, but I'm not sure where it stands right now. We could, when we have our scallop folks here tomorrow, let you know.
Yeah, that would be good. I mean, this gentleman, his concern was that he was going to get a bill in October for $7,000. And I don't know if that's concern is a reality or not. And I do know that you know, it's required up to 3%, and certainly this particular fleet, it could create some hardship for some people. I know in the Bering Sea Crab program, they did a cost recovery program and found out after year one that they had charged them double what they needed to do to implement the program. So in year two, they didn't have to pay anything. And so to the best of our ability to avoid those situations, particularly for small boat fishermen. So I think that was the concern.
Dr. Pierce.
Pat, you indicated that the Mid-Atlantic Council requested that the ABC for black sea bass be increased consistent with the findings of the SSC. Do you have a timetable for implementation of that change?
No. As I said, we are considering emergency action. If we took emergency action, we would try to go directly to final rule, and which can be a fairly short time turnaround. But we've made no decision on that request yet.
David.
Pat, I have a question on the Heron letter that just went out, and I don't know whether now's the time to ask or to wait till the Heron section. I have some people have called me and asked questions about that letter.
Just get clarification on which letter you're talking about, the letter from the regional office?
Right. It just went out last Thursday, I think. Okay. It's about 15 pages. It has examples of...
Yeah.
I think it's quite clear. I mean, you know, I think it's really well done, actually. There's a number of examples of how you treat various situations in herring fishery. But the question was specifically for people with the open category permits. Do they declare, you know, if you have a limited access permit, you have to declare for herring if you intend to possess herring at all. Mm-hmm. But if you're an open category boat, do you have to declare herring if you intend to possess them? That was one question, because this person had a VMS, and then his second question was, well, what about the people that don't have VMS? What do they do? Because you could have a situation where they can, you know, possess up to 6,000 pounds, and they're clearly targeting herring, but at least it appears from the letter that they don't have to declare herring.
Yeah, we would need our herring folks here.
They'll be here this afternoon.
And they'll be here this afternoon. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions for Pat? Maggie?
Good morning. Thank you. I had a question for Pat regarding the agency's disapproval of the Council's Amendment 16 recommendation for the 6-inch gill net pilot program. The sustainable harvest sector, when we submitted our EA and operations plan, requested the ability to participate in that program, and we were advised by your staff to remove that request from our EA and operations plan because it was being considered because it was a council recommendation. So now we're kind of at a loss to what's the process for how we get that reconsidered for the sector.
Our staff is in the process of getting in touch with all the sector managers to talk about what the options are for 2010. So we're going to try to work through a process with all of you.
Jackie.
Thank you, Maggie. Actually, I had my question that I wanted to ask Pat, but I just wanted to make sure our deadlines are tomorrow for modifications for non-fatal flaws for our operations plans, and that's not going to be part of the process. The consideration of 6-inch gill net requests will be a separate process, not for the deadline for tomorrow. Is that right?
A separate process.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything further for Pat? Sally?
Just a question on Amendment 16. and the removal of the 20% allocation cap. I know in your letter you said that NMFS wanted to work with the council to address that. Can you take that any further in terms of a suggestion and timing of that so that people have an idea about when a cap, whatever that might be established through a council process in concert with NMFS?
Yeah, thank you. I actually meant to talk about that when I talked about Amendment 16, and I'm hoping we have the opportunity to talk about that with the council. It seemed like there were a couple of places on the agenda where that might be a suitable discussion, either under Drew's presentation or during the priority discussion. It seemed like there was one other spot potentially, but I'm hoping we do have the opportunity to talk it through with the council. Obviously, if it's a council action, it does depend in part on setting the priority to address it. And so if nothing else, I think we need to touch on it during that discussion.
Anything further for Pat? All right, move on to general counsel. Gene.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Legal profession was busy over the holidays. We got four more lawsuits, various types. We had two lawsuits filed by the same attorney who's also representing the general category scallop, the candidates for general category scallop permits in the challenge to Amendment 11, which is an ongoing lawsuit. They were filed as class actions, one in New Jersey, one in Maryland, basically identical lawsuits to the challenge to Amendment 11. We have filed a motion with respect to the class action suit filed in New Jersey to dismiss it on grounds that it's totally duplicative of the lawsuit that's already before the court, and which has been fully briefed. In fact, we're having a hearing that I can't attend because of the council meeting tomorrow, oral hearing on the cross motions for summary judgment. And also another grounds for dismissing that lawsuit is that the court found it not duplicative. It's outside the 30-day statute of limitations for filing a lawsuit challenging an amendment by the council. And we haven't filed yet a motion, but are intending to with respect to the other lawsuit, which is virtually identical to the amendment lawsuit, but filed in Maryland. We were also filed, a new lawsuit came in from Peter Taylor, a ground fisherman, challenging our recent rule that requires 100% observer coverage in closed area one on herring midwater trawl vessels. Basic challenge is to the provision, which was a change from the proposed rule to the final rule, that allows herring fishermen to retain small amounts of herring in their net after pumping operations. That's basically the gist of the lawsuit. And that was filed in December in federal court in District of Columbia. It was amended to add a plaintiffs in January. So we're in the process of developing the administrative record and answer in that lawsuit. And then we also got a lawsuit filed by a man named Norton who was denied a general category permit. It's basically a challenge to that denial in federal district court in Massachusetts. The basis of the claim is that we didn't adequately consider all of the reports that would have qualified this fisherman for a general category scallop permit. Just a brief update on our other lawsuits that we have pending. The Western Sea lawsuit, which is a challenge to the permit splitting provision in Herring Amendment 1. We just had our third oral hearing in that case, believe it or not, in January. This is a case that was basically dismissed without prejudice because on the government's argument that the plaintiff had not exhausted all administrative records because of a pending appeal in that lawsuit. That lawsuit was reactivated last fall, and we had a hearing, I believe it was in November, and then the court asked for a brief hearing again in January regarding whether overfishing could occur if the permit splitting provision was not in place. In the SBRM case, a lawsuit filed by Oceana challenging the SBRM omnibus amendment, we have filed our initial cross motions for summary judgment, both sides, and we're waiting for the reply from the plaintiff, and then we will reply to that reply. The amendment lawsuit that I mentioned, Amendment 11 lawsuit that I mentioned earlier, has been fully briefed, and the hearing is being held tomorrow in Trenton, New Jersey, Federal District Court. Lovgren versus the agency, which is a challenge to the interim groundfish rule, has been fully briefed, and we're still awaiting a decision by the court or perhaps the scheduling of oral argument. And in the Mid-Coast versus agency lawsuit, which is a challenge to our denial for rulemaking regarding midwater trawl vessels fishing in closed areas, that has also been fully briefed quite a while ago, and we are awaiting a decision in that case as well. So that concludes my report on litigation, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Gene? Mary Beth?
One question on the Mid-Coast lawsuit, Gene. My understanding was that we were waiting for a date for oral hearings. Are you thinking now that will not happen, that it'll just be a decision?
Well, usually a court asks for oral hearings, but not always. So, you know, we don't know what the court may do next. I mean, it's possible the court could just decide the case based on the briefs. I can't recall whether there's been any indication of an oral hearing. I could be not remembering that, if you've heard something more specifically, but I don't think there's been an indication one way or the other in that case.
My understanding was that was what we were waiting for, but perhaps not. It's not a big issue. Right. I was just a question. And then in the Western Sea case, that you're waiting for just a decision at this point?
That's correct.
Any other questions for Gene? Okay. Northeast Fisheries Science Center. All right, Jim.
Thank you, John. I'll start out with some comments about the what's going on with surveys. The center is completing a cooperative research project comparing the catchabilities of the rockhopper sweep with a cookie sweep in southern New England waters. And the some additional work will be done in the Gulf of Maine and on George's Bank later this spring. The center is in discussions with the clam industry and Mid-Atlantic Council staff and academia about conducting the next clam survey in 2010 on a commercial vessel platform. The 2010 spring bottom trawl survey will begin in late February and run through early May with approximately 400 stratified random stations. There will be some talks given during this meeting. First of all, Drew Kitts will be talking today. He's from our social science branch, and he'll be speaking about the monitoring of catch shares programs. Then on Thursday, Dr. Wendy Gabriel will be presenting the findings of the August 2009 peer review of the bottom trawl survey calibration. And either Wendy or Paul Rago will be presenting the proposed SBRM observer prioritization for 2010 also on Thursday morning. And the idea there is to give a presentation and then to request feedback from everyone at the meeting on how the prioritization can be modified to make it better. So there'll be time during that discussion to talk about figuring out exactly how to give feedback and when to provide it. I don't have that ironed out at this time. Then on stock assessments, we completed SARC 49 the first week of December with Atlantic Surf Clam and Butterfish. The right at this moment in Woods Hole, there's a track going on for dogfish, spiny dogfish. And that meeting will last all this week. And it's the first time that dogfish has been in the track process. And I don't know how the meeting's going. It began yesterday, and I didn't have a chance to attend yesterday, and then it's continuing throughout the week. There will also be for mackerel, there will be a track the first week of March. And then also scheduled for the track are the stocks on Georges Bank, Eastern Georges Bank cod, Eastern Georges Bank haddock, and Georges Bank yellowtail, scheduled for the week of July the 19th to the 23rd of 2010. The spring SARC will be the first week in June with sea scallops, monkfish, and pollock on the agenda. Then going towards SARC 51 in December of 2010, there are three hake species that are on the agenda: silver, red, and offshore, as well as Lalago squid. Then one other thing I'd like to mention is there was a request from the New England Council to move the herring assessment up from June of 2012 to make it to December of 2011. And I'll just point out that this is still under consideration and that a final decision will be made at the NRCC after consideration of various trade-offs. And that concludes my report. I'd be happy to answer questions. Thanks.
Just a quick correction. The current herring assessment is scheduled for December of 2012, not June. June?
Well, just two things. Jim, just a question for you. What Paul is going to bring is a report, the required report under the standardized bycatch reporting?
Yes.
And he brought that to us last year, and it's really a lot of information to not see the report before you have the discussion, so I don't know if there's any way that something can be transmitted and copied for us so we could have it as soon as possible. I think it would help the discussion quite a bit. So if someone could look into that, I think it would help the council. And then the herring assessment, we had a significant discussion about that yesterday at the herring committee, and I think maybe that would, again, be an appropriate time to talk about it this afternoon instead of at the moment.
Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary Beth just stated about the discussion we had on the herring benchmark yesterday at the committee. But question to you, John, is when is the next NRCC meeting scheduled? Thanks.
Either April or May.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I have down May 13th and 14th, Thursday, Friday. Okay. Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, Jim, the question I have is on the calibration conversions from the Albatross to the Bigelow. Where are we in that process? Have we got a you know, have we got those conversions done yet? What I'm specifically concerned with is our index-based stocks and how we're going to treat them. We have quite a number of them, as you know, and from what I understand, some have nice, clean graphs, you know, good conversion rates, quite consistent, and others are kind of all over the board. So I was wondering if you could update us on that a little bit.
Yeah, that will actually be the what Wendy's coming to speak about. So I don't really want to go into it now.
Anyone else for Jim? Okay, thanks, Jim. Anything to report from the mid? Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The mid met in Delaware mid-December to set the recreational measures for summer flounder, scuppin, and black sea bass. Summer flounder, they went with state equivalency. Scup, bit of a problem with scup, but they voted for the federal measures. There's a meeting, SSC. Atlantic States will be meeting next week to decide what to do with the states. There was a problem with the Massachusetts data for wave three on the MRFs. It gets worse because I don't think there is any wave five or any six, but I guess it's not a temporary. The final rule has already been published, so who knows. Sea bass, is the same situation Pat mentioned earlier, that there's an emergency action. They've request for emergency action on sea bass, lies with the service. And they set the dogfish specs, and that was basically about it. So two out of three species are so-so.
Any questions for Frank or anyone want to add anything? Okay. U.S. Coast Guard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Slide. And next one. During the reporting period on the slide, the Coast Guard conducted 546 boardings. During those boardings, we issued 10 fisheries violations, resulting in an observed compliance rate of 98.2%. Next slide. In those same 546 boardings, 124 commercial fishing vessels were issued safety violations, resulting in an observed compliance rate of 77.3%. And this represents a slight decrease from the last reporting period, which was September to November. 198 commercial fishing vessel safety exams were conducted, and 144 decals were issued. 15 safety terminations were also conducted. And during the reporting period, the Coast Guard responded to 31 fishing vessel casualties. While responding to these casualties and conducting 5 medevacs, 50 lives were saved. Life rafts, immersion suits, and EPIRBs continue to be the most important life-saving equipment. And unfortunately, 2 lives were lost during this time period as well. Next slide. With respect to EPIRBs, I would like to stress the importance of properly registered EPIRB. Recent polling that we've been doing shows that there's a significant amount of registration data that is inaccurate or out of date, and accurate EPIRB contact information gives us the best chance to respond to an activated EPIRB. Often the first indication of an EPIRB alert comes without information on location. It's picked up by a weather satellite, and that allows us to immediately begin action on the case by rapidly contacting the owner or other designated person to get information on the vessel's location. Also, it allows us to rapidly identify inadvertently activated EPIRBs. The First District Rescue Coordination Center receives, on average, 1 uncorrelated EPIRB distress signal per day, and the ability to determine a false alarm saves a significant amount of operational resources. We provided pamphlets on EPIRB registration at the table in the lobby. EPIRB registration can be verified on the NOAA website that's listed on the slide, the next slide here. Rodney Avila made me aware this morning of an EPIRB model that's having problems and is no longer being serviced by the manufacturer, but the manufacturer is offering a credit toward the purchase of a new EPIRB. Rodney's going to get that information to me, and we're going to get that on the tables as well. Next slide. And finally, a reminder that Loran C. Signals will be terminating on 8 February. Signals bound by international agreement, such as the U.S.-Canadian 5930 line, will continue broadcasting until June. That concludes my report, Mr. Chairman. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Any questions for Pete? Terry?
Yeah, Pete, is there any pattern in the safety violations that can be addressed by further outreach?
The violations are pretty consistent, sure. Overdue survival craft inspections, expired flares, expired hydrostatic releases, fire extinguisher maintenance. It's the usual suspects just about every time. So we continue to focus on that through our voluntary inspection program, and we've also been, it's also been part of our training series on upright and watertight that we've been doing. So it's all out there. Anything we can do to get folks to get those voluntary exams would be great.
Any other questions? Thanks, Pete. Enforcement, VMS.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Tim Donovan, one of Andy's deputies. Andy Coing had a scheduling conflict. He's down in Maryland this week, so I'll handle the briefing this morning, as well as Bill will handle VMS. Start off with a good news story. During the holiday season, our agents down south in the New Jersey area were able to, working with the National Seafood Inspection Lab, were able to donate 700 cans of banded tuna on a false labeling case to a New Jersey food bank during the holiday season. We had one pulse operation down on the Point Judith area, working with Coast Guard and our state JA partners, Rhode Island DEM. 21 fishing vessels were boarded over a two-day operation with only one violation detected. An illegal alien had been circumventing detection for 13 years, was taken into custody by Immigration Customs Enforcement and deported the following day. On the border in the Calais, Maine Port of Entry facility, working with uniformed officers on TDY from our Alaska office, Customs Border Patrol, Anti-Terrorism Unit, and Maine Marine Patrol, they conducted a six-day operation. During this period, 65 tractor-trailer trucks hauling lobster from the Maritimes were subjected to inspection. Violations were found on 30 trucks hauling illegal lobsters, including short, egg-bearing, and V-notch lobsters. Also, during this time frame, most of you have seen it this week, the Inspector General report has come out. The Office of Law Enforcement, we're still digesting the report, working through some of the recommendations, but I do want to address some of the key points that Dr. Lipchenko has provided to us, no administrator. The agency's enforcement and general counsel office has been directed to take steps to promote greater transparency in law enforcement, ensure fairness and penalties, and improve lines of communication with commercial and recreational fishermen. This nationwide review showed that we can do a better job in this regard, and she ensures that we will take steps to improve the system and to reinforce confidence in the system in the interest of the fisheries resource and all who are dependent upon its viability. One key fact is effective February 1st, NOAA's new general counsel, Lois Schiffer, Gene, I think that's the correct pronunciation, Schiffer, to lead a high-level review of existing policies and procedures, recommending ways to improve our operations. Dr. Lipchenko mentioned convening a national summit. I don't have any details of that. I do know that working with our general counsel staff here in the Northeast, Senior Attorney Mitch McDonald, we're in the process of trying to do a regional summit as well. We'll have more details as soon as that's available. To end off on that Dr. Chenko was confident that we will develop innovative and responsive approaches that will improve NOAA's enforcement capabilities while fostering a better immediate and long-term working relationship with our customers. Here in the Northeast, the Office of Law Enforcement will continue to work with industry, the councils, both New England and Mid-Atlantic, the regional office, our Coast Guard partners, and our state enforcement partners to do a better job of enforcing the regulations. At this point, that concludes my half of the report, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Bill Semro, Northeast VMS Program Manager in Law Enforcement, Gloucester. I've got some slides up there on the screen, and you should have some copies in front of you. First, the new VTRAC monitoring system is operational now for about 4 or 5 months. This is the VMS monitoring system that is used by NOAA Fisheries nationwide. It's also being used by the Coast Guard and by the state JEA partners. In fact, the Coast Guard is having good success in deploying VTRAC on some of their underway cutters. I know they've tested it successfully on a medium endurance cutter, a patrol boat, and an ocean-going buoy tender. So it is helpful, obviously, for not only law enforcement, but also for search and rescue. Secondly, we're working on the VMS specifications for Groundfish Amendment 16. This is a collaboration between OLE and SFD in the region to translate your Amendment 16 requirements into VMS requirements for the vessel-side VMS units, and also changes to our VTRAC system as well. In OLE, we're required to give the VMS contractor and the three vendors, Boatrax, SkyMate, and GMPCS, at least 60 days advance notice of the changes that they need to make to the software on the vessels. We've actually backed it up another 30 days, so the slide shows that my intent is to submit the VMS requirements via the specifications by February 1st. And I know that's well in advance of when the actual final rule will be out on the street. I believe Pat Kirkle mentioned April, but we can't obviously wait that long, and we are constrained by at least 60 days. We're giving it the extra month because there are extensive changes to the VMS software with this action, which I'll explain in a moment. And we also have a new VMS contractor who will be seeing this for the first time, and therefore we want to give them as much time as possible to make these changes. Third, we are making extensive revisions to the groundfish and monkfish declaration screens. This is what the users, the operators on the vessels, will be seeing in order to make their activity declarations prior to sailing, and I'll show you those in a moment. Also, there are some new VMS forms, like the sector trip hail and the sector trip hail start and hail end, and some others. We've also, at our SFD request, revised the groundfish catch report as well. I'll show you those. And finally, on this slide, it's pretty telling that the declarations are going to expand significantly. That is the VMS codes that those are familiar with, that 12-character code when the operator makes their menu selections prior to sailing to describe their activity. That comes to us as a 12-character code and is processed by our monitoring system. We currently have 403 unique valid codes in the Northeast. With Amendment 16, we'll be going up to 2,700. And the bulk of those codes, as shown on the slide, are related to the groundfish changes, the multi-species screen, and also to the monkfish screen, since those two plans are very closely linked. No changes to the scallop, surf clam, ocean quahog, or herring, or declare out of fishery codes, of which there are 30 total. So the other 2,670 are due to the multi-species and monkfish changes. And next slide, please. For those that haven't seen it before, and I know this is kind of an eye chart, and people in the back won't be able to see it, but you can refer to your slides in front of you for the council members. For those that that operate VMS, this will look familiar to them, although, you know, depending on the equipment you have, the format is going to be different, but the information is the same. At the top of the screen is, this is the groundfish declaration, by the way. The changes under Amendment 16 are highlighted in yellow. At the top, and I'll go through this very quickly, the monkfish option, which doesn't change. Secondly, would be the gear type selection. That hasn't changed. Next is the select the broad stock area. That is new, and it requires the user to check all that apply. And there are various combinations of those four, whether it's the Gulf of Maine, inshore Georges Bank, offshore Georges Bank, or southern New England. And that's where you can get up to 15, iterations of a single code by making a broad stock area selection. Next is something new, which is to select whether you're going out on a sector or common pool trip. More specifically, it's really whether you're going to be taking a day at sea trip or not. You would select either a common pool or sector trip on a multi-species day at sea, or a sector trip when not on a multi-species day at sea. And then at the bottom of the screen would be where the user selects the fisheries program. That's the same as before, but we've added some of the additional eastern U.S. Canada areas that I understand may open next year, and that would be VMS areas 1, 3, 7, and 8. And that's those are various combinations of the eastern U.S. Canada area and the closed area 2 yellowtail sap and the eastern U.S. Canada haddock sap as well. Next screen. What you're looking at here is an extension of the multi-species declaration screen. Under the BDAS program, the only change there is a note that says that applies to the common pool only. Everything else is essentially the same. Closed Area 1 hook gear haddock sap selection below that hasn't changed. And then there is a new change at the very bottom, which is to add a concurrent scallop day at sea trip. This is something that the SFD has requested, which allows for a ground fisherman to go out, and if they've got a limited access scallop permit, to also go out on a scallop day at sea. So they would, if they want to declare this, they would be charged the scallop days at sea to their multi-species trip. It's for trawl only, and there's a note there that also says that they must declare their scallop day at sea trip using IVR. So they would declare their groundfish trip through VMS. If they take advantage of this concurrent scallop day at sea, they check that box. Then they would have to call the IVR to initiate the scallop days at sea prior to sailing. Next screen, please. This is what the monkfish declaration screen will look like under Amendment 16. Again, I should make it clear these are final drafts. We're looking to finalize these this week so that we can get them submitted via work order to our headquarters and then out to the vendors and the contractor on February 1. Gear type hasn't changed. Select management area, whether it's the northern fishery management area or the some part of the trip being fished in the southern fishery management area. The next part is a selection for the broad stock area, exactly the same as what was on the groundfish screen. Next would be selecting the fisheries program, whether it's regular access, U.S. Canada Area West, U.S. Canada East. And there we've added again VMS areas 1, 3, 7, and 8 to the existing 2, 5, and 6. The flex options are in there as well for both groundfish and monkfish. Obviously, any flex options related to the southern New England differential days at sea area or the Gulf of Maine differential days at sea area have been removed. Offshore area access, highlighted in yellow there. We just made a note, an additional note that says, a reminder that it's for permit category F only. And finally, the note there about adding a concurrent scallop day at sea trip, which is consistent with what's on the groundfish screen. And finally, I wanted to show you the scallop declaration screen. I made some minor text changes to that screen. Under the general category power down, I improved the text hopefully to so that folks aren't trying to sail on a power down code. We still have limited access general category. Fishermen are going out on a power down code, and that's never authorized. That code is strictly for the dock or mooring, which allows you to turn the unit off after sending that code. So we tried to clarify that language there. And last, under the limited access section, I've moved up the compensation trip declaration in the hierarchy because some limited access fishermen are forgetting to declare whether they're going out on a compensation trip or not. They would select the area, whether it's Elephant Trunk or Delmarva or what have you, and they would forget that piece below it, which is, I'm not going out on a comp trip or I am going out on a comp trip. So we've put the comp trip above that to make it a little more evident. It's really not an issue for vessels that have SkyMate or Tron, but it can be for those that have boat tracks. Because as people know that have boat tracks, it has the entire screen there, and you could put an X just about anywhere and end up sending an invalid code. So next, and I'll move through these very quickly. Next slide, please. The multi-species catch report, you'll notice that we've increased the number of species that need to be reported by the four broad stock areas. And the instruction at the top says that this report is to be used for trips into multiple broad stock areas, U.S.-Canada management area, the regular BDAS program, and or special access programs, and submit before the end of the trip for multiple BSA trips or daily by 9 a.m. the day after the fish were caught for all other trips, and report species in pounds kept. For all fish kept, include total pounds of all ground fish and non-ground fish. Next slide, please. This is what the sector trip start and sector trip end hail messages will look like. For those that can't see it, the hail message requires the permit number, the VTR serial number, the landing state, the landing port, the ETA, in month, day, hour, and minute, and then the estimated offload month, day, hour, and minute. Under trip end, the report says this report must be sent 6 hours before arrival for all ground fish trips. If fishing ends less than 6 hours before landing, then the report is to be sent immediately upon leaving the fishing grounds. And the required entries are permit number, VTR, landing state, landing port, dealer, estimated arrival, estimated offload, and if there is a second offload state, provide that, as well as the second offload port, total ground fish kept, and then total of all other species kept in pounds. And then finally, the restricted gear area notification, and the instruction is that vessels declaring a multi-species day at sea and intend to fish all or part of their trip within NRGA are required to send this form prior to leaving port. You must comply with all gear requirements within the RGA. Other gear is not allowed on board while in the RGA, and there's a selection either for the Western Georges Bank RGA or the Southern New England RGA. And that completes my brief. Thank you.
Any questions? David?
Yes, Bill. On the page, I think it's the second to last page, sector trip start and end hail date, is the top part sort of like the acknowledgement you're sending now on the days at sea? I mean, this is sent from the dock, right?
That's right. It's sent from port. Just like when you send your activity code
right.
Through VMS, you would go to your forms and send the trip.
Okay.
Start. Yes.
And the one at the end, you know, most of us fish within 6 hours of port, you know, by numbers of people. So we'll just send that the minute we start going home, even if it only takes us 20 minutes to get home.
That's my understanding, Dave.
Okay.
But that could change this week as soon as I get confirmation. But that's my understanding currently.
Okay. Well,
yes.
Mike, now, my concern is, But you don't have to wait outside the demarcation line to receive an acknowledgement from this bottom one, right?
No.
Okay. That's important because, some of these acknowledgements take forever. I mean, this past weekend, they weren't doing very well. I had one was 2 hours and 15 minutes, and another was an hour and 35 minutes to get an acknowledgement. I was fishing both times. No, one time I was fishing before I got the acknowledgement. So I just want to make sure nobody's going to be required to stay at sea under deteriorating weather conditions, as an example.
Not to my knowledge, Dave.
Okay. So we won't need, then, some kind of backup IVR system or something. That's my question, is we're going to need something to, you know, pick up your cell phone when this won't go through for whatever reason and call somebody and tell them.
I think that the sector managers may be, in their operations plans, may be authorizing various modes of reporting, trip start or trip end, with VMS being one of those. I don't know if that's something that Dan Morris will speak to or if it's going to be more high level in his briefing this morning. But to my knowledge, first of all, there isn't the acknowledgement that comes back like there is for a declaration.
Okay. That was one of my major concerns.
I understand. And I don't think the intent is to make you wait out there, because there won't be a requirement for an acknowledgement. No.
Okay. Very good. That's what I was concerned with, was that there might be this. At one time it was discussed that you'd have to wait for an acknowledgement to go in. You'd have to send this trip hail and then wait to get something back that said it had been received. And based on my work with the study fleet, you know, when you start sending these bigger files, at least with SkyMate, our success rate's about 25% of actually having one go through and getting something back that says it got sent successfully. So I'm concerned.
Yeah, I understand. Obviously, this is going to the sector manager, and it's going to enforcement, it's going to the regional office, and, you know, a variety of addressees, and there has to be that communication that goes from the vessel out to the sector manager. Something's going to have to come back, but there are various means to communicate, whether it's through VMS or through cell phone when you get close enough to shore, and to coordinate the offload.
Yeah, I have no problem with calling somebody. I know SkyMate seems to have a very specific problem. It seems to be early in the morning, and it's something to do with the orbit of the satellite, that it's basically under the horizon. And if you're steaming east and the satellite's behind you, it just doesn't, nothing happens for, between like 5 and 7 in the morning, which is when a lot of day boats are leaving. So.
Yeah, Dave, I'm familiar, with
yeah,
those
I know,
orbiting
we've
satellites.
Talked about it a lot.
Right, there have been delays. I'm very.
But, they put a new thing in there, and they're updated program, so you can actually watch when a satellite comes on and the angle it's at and whatnot. And it seems to be that when they first pop up, when they finally show, they show very low on the horizon, very, mm-hmm. very near the horizon. And I think it has something to do with, like, small boats. The antennas are close to the water, so if you've got big waves in a small boat, you may not be able to pick it up.
Yeah, right. And then transmit, because you've got to have that link.
Right. It's got to go up and back. That's
their station.
So
right.
I just want to make sure people are aware of the issues that may come up surrounding sending electronic
reports.
That's
a good point. And that's something that the sector managers are just going to have to be aware of. There may be some delay there, but again, you get close enough in, if you're able to, talk by cell phone or sat phone, there's another alternative there.
Any other questions? Mary Beth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to go back to the enforcement report, the activity in Calais with trucks coming across the border, I don't know how much information you have on that, but the compliance rate by truck is like around 50%. It's pretty horrendous. And I know that you've conducted these type of operations in the past. Is this unusual? It seems to be, hopefully, by lobster, the rate's not 50%, but certainly by truck, it's pretty close.
I don't have the full information on that one, as far as historical compliance on that. I do know, though, that generally around the holidays, that we will pick up an increasing amount of violations. What's different about this, I think this operation, maybe in some of the past, is this Calais the Calais Port of Entry is a new facility. And we're working with those teams, we can expect more trucks. and that's different than in the past. And that, so I would be more concerned about next year's, next time we do an operation, and the same situation available. I know in the past we have not been able to get into as many trucks or as deep into the trucks just because of the facility there that's inside, it's refrigerated, and we can actually get into more vehicles.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I would hope that the violations would, send a message to Canadian companies that they need to pay closer attention.
That was one of the main primary purposes of the operation.
Paul Howard.
What about U.S. companies that the lobster was bound for? Is there any violation about accepting illegal product?
Paul, I don't believe there was any U.S. companies that were received any. I can follow up with the agent that handled that operation, but I don't believe there's any further action against those companies. Most of the stuff was handled right at the border, and a lot of those trucks were turned back.
Anything further? Okay. Thank you. Anything to bring forward on ASMFC issues? It's on the agenda. Anyone? You meet next week. Okay. So move on to the EFP agenda item. I think there's one item. Tab 14, Chris Kellogg, can just brief the council quickly. 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 Just brief the council quickly.